We have to admit there's a certain level of artifice in society. Few people expect everyone to be absolutely honest all the time. You know, you don't walk up to people in the street and say, wow, did you get any sleep last night? Or things like that. But how much artifice is too much? Our guest this hour urges people to be open and honest with one another when working together in organizations from the top down. The standard arrangement, as Thompson Barton sees it, is also the title of his book, Please Lie to Me. Thompson Barton got degrees in economics and in holistic psychology. He and Don White, his co-author, started an organizational transformation firm based on accountable communication technology, note the acronym ACT, in 1991. Thompson Barton joins us in the studio. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I love this show. I've been listening to it since 2000, I think.
Wow, excellent. Thank you so much for being here. The book starts with a foreword from an ACT client, and it really underscores from the get-go that this is really about directness, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
All right, so that quickly gets us to a discussion of tennis. How does tennis figure in how you got to this book?
Yeah, for many years I taught tennis and played tennis for many years, and I've learned about a fellow named Tim Galway who wrote it, and this was in 1974-5, who wrote a book titled The Inner Game of Tennis. And I realized when I just started reading that book, literally the first 3 or 4 pages, that what this guy had figured out is what I've been trying to, would love to know and been trying to figure out, and everybody I knew for as long as I've been playing, which was how to reach what's called the zone, which is a state of non-anxious performance, which means that I will, and anyone else, will play absolutely their best tennis without being nervous, distracted, self-critical, anything that's distracting goes away when you're in what's called the zone. And Galway had figured technically how to do that in tennis. And so I couldn't get enough of it. So I signed up for his workshop, went down to LA and took 10 days of his workshop. And in that workshop, it was profound for me and all the about 20 other players. And we would talk a lot about the sessions. He would give us activities to do, and then we would have these profoundly great sessions of playing tennis. We'd come back, and then he would talk to us about what happened, how the technique worked. And one of the comments he made early on was, he said, look, how you approach or think about playing tennis and then how you engage and how you play it at any given moment is a metaphor for how you live. Essentially, how you regard yourself and your performance and all your anxieties, you're going to bring them there. Because it's in your mind, it's win-lose and your self-concept up for grabs. So he had figured out a way to create tennis as a meditation, the tennis ball in particular. And that was so profound that I wanted more of that and I was teaching sports psychology at the time in Bend, so I wanted to get a master's and PhD and just stay in this world. I just loved it. So I went off to graduate school to the holistic psychology program down in San Francisco in 79. Well, it turns out, and it wasn't just a random pick, I had liked the faculty and the curriculum, but it turns out Will Schutz had figured out how to do sort of the inner game of business and the inner game of business meetings and the inner game of relationships. And so he, and I was intrigued by that. I could do it in sports and with teams, but business? And so I got more and more involved in what he was teaching in the basis of the graduate school, which was high functioning for human beings based on two things. This was Will's work and Will's, he had founded the graduate school. Two things. One, being straight, being honest, being real. And the second, taking complete responsibility for your experience. Just as I say it nowadays, take the blame card out of your deck. You don't get to blame yourself, people, other people, or anything else.
And yet the book starts, your first words in the book are, I am a recovering liar and blamer in a society awash with pretending and blaming.
Yes. Yes, all that is how I see it. I regard myself as recovering because every day, today already, I've noticed that I have the chance to be open and direct or to withhold and to be defensive and to blame, because I was coming here and the traffic, there was and I took a back way that I thought would be make sure that I got here on time. And lo and behold, they're doing street work, right? And there's a person up there holding traffic up. And I just had to look at that and go, you know, okay, now what am I going to tell Jeffrey if I'm late? You know, I'm going to blame it on that. Recovering, I just see myself definitely as a recovering liar. The temptation to not be real every day, I find it is there. It's just like a drug deal is how I put it. The comfort zone is kind of a drug deal. And to be straight and sober, is kind of like cold turkey. But every day is an opportunity for me to be in every moment, to be real or not, and then to take responsibility, full responsibility, for what's happening in the moment or not.
But this is openness, you say, which is not the same thing as brutal honesty. So how hard is it to be real on a regular basis? And then are you still leaving some room for people's feelings? Is that why it's not brutal honesty?
Okay, let me unpack that. I'm glad you brought that up, because the one of the first reactions people have to the idea about being open is they have in their lives many instances for themselves on a daily basis about, oh, right, I'm just going to be open and it's going to make this relationship a mess. Brutally honest is not honesty. It is about brutality, and here's what I mean. The intent of brutally honest is actually to be critical and get by with it. Well, okay, you want me to be brutally honest? And you can just hear the tone. All right, I'm just about to unload on you the stuff I haven't said, and it's got this tone of criticism, and that's what makes it brutal. And it is brutal. It's not straight. Now, it's so important to distinguish between what I call and have named accountable openness as opposed to brutally honest or unaccountable openness. And by accountable openness, it would mean that let's just say that I were feeling quite jealous or intimidated in your presence, and in a meeting, I wanted to make you kind of look bad because I'm threatened by you on our team. And so I would look for opportunities to criticize you in the meeting. And that would really be driven by my fear that you're smarter than I am, you're quicker than I am, I see you as somehow a threat. And so my openness towards you is really not meant to be information. It is meant to put you down. It's a form of criticism. That is brutally honest, and I call it unaccountable, because if I were to be honest with you, it would sound like this. You know, Jeffrey, I notice I've been sitting here listening to this presentation you're doing, and I'm trying to find something wrong with it, because I really want to criticize you. I feel really competitive with you, and I did that presentation last week, and I don't think it came off as well as I, and you're coming off better than I. Now, who does that? But that's what it means to be accountable, which is I'm being that revealing about myself.
Okay, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. The book is called Please Lie to Me, Thompson, Barton, and You, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Thompson Barton, who's a business consultant with degrees in economics and holistic psychology. He and Don White, his co-author, started an organizational transformation firm based on accountable communication technology. And he wrote a book with Don White called Please Lie to Me, which he says is generally the transaction we have in the workplace, where the artifice is everything. And we'll get further into that right now. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone. Phones are working. Email address to jx@jeffnet.org. So what then makes us be this way? When you talk about this is not about brutal honesty, because that's more about brutality than about honesty. What stops us from being open and honest with people?
One word, fear. Now, fear? Fear of what? Fear of, if I were to say what I really am thinking, it might sound stupid. The fear of being laughed at. The fear of, one of my, I think, most telling phrases in our language is the phrase, I could have died of embarrassment. So I'm going to be very careful to make sure that I don't look like an idiot, or that I put myself on the spot or put you on the spot. Then we've got perhaps a problem, because you won't like it because I put you on the spot. So in a word, it's fear. It's the fear that, well, you wouldn't like me. You know, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. If I really let you know me, let you know this or that about me, you wouldn't like me, or you wouldn't respect me. Or you wouldn't find me interesting if I said a few things. Well, this person doesn't know much. He's not interesting. You would turn away and not be interested in me. So it is the fear of another person's reactions that causes us to be so careful in one another's presence. There's a phrase my business partner used once that really sticks with me, because I was raised in the South, which is the opposite of polite is not rude. The opposite of polite is real. It took me, I'm not kidding, it took me about 5 weeks to actually assimilate that, given how I was raised. But you see the intent behind it, and is what's so important. But it's the fear of upsetting someone, and that upsetting the relationship, or appearing incompetent, appearing unlikable or appearing simply not interesting.
Well, let me jump ahead then, because this really gets into some power relationships too, because, I mean, it can't be that one person in an organization decides, I'm going to be real with everyone, because that person could get canned if they're really honest with their boss and their boss isn't ready for a program like this. You do tend to work through the owners and managers of businesses, don't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you, first of all, deal with the managers and say, okay, you need to allow your people to be candid with you, to be open and honest, and not want to can them because of it?
Well, okay, so here's the short on that. When there's a company or when there's an owner or an executive that's get interested in trust building, which this work amounts to trust building. So when they get interested in trust building, the first conversation I have with them, I say, why does it matter to you that people trust one another here? And I'm looking for a business explanation. I'm not looking for it's morally right. If we're morally right, everybody already be doing that. If they believe that. So what's the business reason? What's it costing you for people not being open? And I want to see that they begin to at least got some sense of what they're suffering from here. And so then the next question is, do you want the people that report to you, your executive team or your management team that reports to you, the people that report to you, do you want those people to be open and honest with you? This is the very seminal question. And I'm looking at them and I'm listening and I don't want a book answer. I want to see that it actually matters and that it's not an easy answer to come up with. So the hard swallow and, well, I really do. All right, then what I have called accountable communication technology, we will do this thing, and they're going to experience being open with you. Now, I will tell you right now, they're not open with you or wouldn't be having this conversation because they're afraid of you. I'm not saying that you've done that to them on purpose, but there's this thing about authority figures typically in our lives. And if I say, you remember what yes men means? And they always shake their head, yes. Okay, well, that's everybody telling you, boss, what you want to hear because they don't want to upset you because they don't want to be fired. So that's how this game goes. But if you want them to get real, then you're going to have to convince them that you really want that versus it's some kind of clever trap. And so what we do in the workshop is we break through all those fears by actually having them give the boss feedback, and they get to see that nobody gets fired. The boss really appreciates it. And then we've begun transformation from that fear I talked about. Mm-hmm. We've begun to break that down, break through that old taboo and that old belief. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Okay. Thompson Barton's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book with Don White is called Please Lie to Me, which is their interpretation of the existing transactional agreements we have with the people we tend to work with. And they're offering up a different one in the book. You can join the conversation on the exchange about openness, honesty, not brutality, honesty. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about the difference between the opposite of polite is real, but here again, you know, the fact is that you do end up with dealing with other people's defensiveness, and that is well charted in the book. So even when you're trying to be as open as you possibly can, you're still dealing with the possibility of somebody else's defense mechanisms kicking in. And I guess we wouldn't call them mechanisms if they didn't seem to happen automatically. So how then do you get people in a setting where they trust enough that they know they can say something, whether the other person going, what do you mean? Or, you know, doing mm-hmm. whatever the defense mechanism might be.
Mm-hmm. The short answer is one sentence at a time. Slowly is the answer. Back when I was a kid, and for many people, I think they remember a game when we were kids called Alley, Alley, Outson Free, or something we used to say during a game, Alley, Alley, Outson Free. Do you mm-hmm. remember that?
Yeah. Oxen Free, we thought it was on Long
Oxen
Island.
Free. But yeah. And actually, that means everyone who is out hiding can come in free. But kids have over the years have become Alley, Alley, Outson, Oxen Free. What did it mean back then for you?
Everybody come in. Yeah. Game's over. That kind of thing.
Come in from hiding.
Right.
Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is just a new game, Jeff. It's like alley, alley, Outson Free. Everybody can come in from hiding because everybody's hiding. Now, you cannot tell a workforce to become open. Not a chance. You actually prove to them that it's safe to come out of hiding. And that happens one game, one sentence at a time, so that everyone can see that there's not going to be retribution. This is a business conversation, and I'm actually being respected rather than set up when I'm being open. And again, the openness is not your right to have cheap shots and criticize. We want to know that that's how you're feeling, But that is not, again, the openness. The openness is the openness. Accountable openness is becoming transparent. So you can imagine how appealing that is to us. And a really simple way to know whether I trust someone is how transparent I am in their presence. Now, that said, we always think it's about someone else. But what's true is, how much do I trust myself in your presence? So to the extent that I trust myself in your presence, Jeffrey, I would be open with you about me because I can handle, like, what do you like about me? What do you not like about me? Who does that? And I really want to know what you don't like. I'd love to hear what you like. Well, that's nice. But what's important is going to drive our relationship. The problem in our relationship is what you don't like about me. So do we have a relationship such that you can tell me that right in the moment and you know that I'm receptive, I want to hear it, and you can see that I value it and it matters to me? That's how we retrain one another from the please lie to me to please be straight with me. And thus I come to the I'm a recovering liar. So I hang out with recovering liars because we all keep one another straight. And it's not because it's a religion. It's because it's functional. It's like, I don't like myself when I'm not being straight with you. And I don't like people around me who are not straight with me. It's way easier to be around people that I don't have to read between the lines. That's just tedious. So I want to hang with people who we're committed to really helping one another be real and straight in one another's company. And that takes coming out of hiding and having a support group. So it's a training, and you take an organization and they get committed, and we just have the technology to do that. Does that make sense?
It does. But I'm still curious about the people who think that there is a strength in withholding information, you know, that I have greater power if I know something you don't.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that sort of situation in a post please lie to me arrangement?
If you put the context of trust, how important is it that we, this group, or these two people trust one another? That particular strategy cannot live in the petri dish of trust. It can't. You have to give that up. So you do not, one is not trusting, nor are they trusted when we withhold. And by the way, roughly about 80% of our communication with one another is nonverbal. We are exquisite at trying to figure out if someone is straight or not. That's the first thing we try to do in meeting anybody. And we look at them, we watch them, and we listen to the tone of voice. You can't not do that. It is basic to our survival. It's amygdala stuff. You can't not do it. So we're looking one another all over all the time. Most of the time, we don't expect people to be straight.
Oh, so when you say it's amygdala stuff, this is ancient brain stuff.
Like, it is survival stuff.
Is this creature going to eat me?
Yeah, exactly. Because I want to know what's real about you. Then I can do something about it. But if I don't know what's really going on with you, then I can't deal with it. So you see, I am designed to find out what's really going on with you. And your fear is that if I really knew what was going on with you, then I would take advantage of you. So your job is to keep me from knowing you. That's that old game. It's based on fear.
Thompson Barton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He and Don White, the co-authors of the book, Please Lie to Me, about the way that they see people generally transacting with each other in the workplace. And they work very hard to change that in their work. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email from Jeff in Ashland who wants to know if you're familiar with the therapist, author, and speaker Esther Perel or Perel. She talks about the difference between honesty and truth, both in quotes, in personal relationships, stating that we as Americans feel compelled to be brutally honest, but not necessarily truthful.
I don't, and I agree with that.
All right, the whole idea, though, about the fact that we, and it must have been like a degree of difficulty harder for you growing up in Arkansas and Tennessee, I'm thinking, where people do say really nice things and don't necessarily mean them. You know, I can't believe they rehired that guy. Hey, Jim, good to see you back. That kind of stuff, you know?
I remember going to church and sitting in church, going through church with my parents, and then we'd be headed to the parking lot and get in the car, and there would be so much criticism of the people in the pew next to us or how somebody's voice sounded. But they wouldn't tell those people. But here we just come from church. So that was all that I knew, was the careful pretending and the being nice. Always be nice. Most important thing is to be nice. You wouldn't want to not be nice.
Right.
And so, in fact, here's this phrase, and I'm sure listeners have heard it before, but if you can't say something nice, don't say it.
Right.
Okay, well, what was I supposed to do as a kid when I wasn't feeling nice? I wasn't up for pretending, and I was upset or I was angry about something. Well, in that culture, you learn to pretend, to not express that. And so early on, we're taught to pretend and everybody else is doing it. And I know I'm doing it, so I figure you're doing it. That's how that goes.
Grab your headphones. We have a call here. Let us enter into the conversation. David in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Thompson Barton, the co-author of...
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Tommy.
Go ahead.
I've had an opportunity to work with Tommy and Don some years ago in small group situations. I'm familiar with his work, and I really do appreciate what he's done over so many years. And my question is regarding trauma-informed protocol. In organizations or in a therapeutic situation, this is a real currency these days, is trauma-informed care, trauma-informed education, have a trauma-informed organization. So that in doing what you're doing so well, how does a boss, a worker, an employee be aware of the triggers that are there that trigger a trauma response when threatened?
Okay, thanks for the question, David. Let's find out what Thompson's thinking about it.
Yeah, if I'm following your question, that would become, it would be brought up in my being open about the trauma that I had, some trauma that I had in the past, and say, you know, every time I see someone just stand, someone that's just taller than I am, that just reminds me of this person that abused me a great deal, and I notice I already get defensive. And so, you know, when I was hired in here and then I started working for Jim and he was this 6'4" guy, I noticed that I just got triggered. So I was just so intimidated in his presence, and that's why I'm kind of showing up in the meetings as quiet and not saying anything, because I just are having trouble with that. Now, what happens when someone is willing to express that and the people involved in the team or the gym in this case hears this, then it's taken into account and we begin to know where to go with the next step about, well, what would make a difference here for you? And you probably know this based on that depth of question, is just to express that to someone that in whose presence you've been withholding that begins to change the relationship. It begins to free one because they're not going to be treated by this person who's larger than they are in the way in which they were treated and abused by the person who, in fact, was larger and did abuse them. But it takes some relearning there, and it only starts when that exact fear and the history gets expressed. I do a lot of that in part of our 5-day workshop. We get to that with, because everybody's got some measure of trauma, and it's astonishing. I just wish you could see what would happen, but it's astonishing the trauma that people have been through and still show up in the workforce, and then what can happen when collectively 10 people sit around and go, that happened to you, well, this happened, that happened to you, and then it's there's so much support and bonding by virtue of that, and collectively they move out of it. I think that psychology has kind of gotten a corner on therapy, and when it's really before that, the Greeks were doing this sort of thing and not calling it therapy. It's just people becoming more transparent, and in that transparency, there is compassion that flows. My experience, anyway, is that the other people in the group have compassion rather than judgment, and they don't shun the person; they embrace the person. And this happens in the workplace. It happens in the workplace. So it's exciting to me and so rewarding to see that. Thanks for that.
In your sessions with organizations then, Thompson, where do you place the primary responsibility that an individual feels? Is it to themselves? Is it to the organization, to the boss? I mean, where is there any discussion of that?
I'm not following that. Say more.
Well, when you're trying to fix things, is the responsibility to fix them for yourself? Are you fixing them for the people? Are you fixing them for the whole organization? I mean, who are you primarily responsible to as you attempt to get realer with people?
And when you say you mean me or you mean an employee?
The person, yeah.
Okay. Well, if I follow that question, it's I would do this for myself, and I would begin to – I think I'm going to go back to the alley outs and free. I would begin to divulge my fears to you, to the group, as I saw someone else divulge theirs. So it becomes, quote, and this is in quotes, safe. I don't think it's ever safe because I'm still feeling some anxiety. But one person says a little something, I didn't know that about you. Wow, that was true of you. And that simply evokes empathy from me, and I share something about similar about me. And then someone else shares something similar about them. And so it starts as individuals, and then it gathers momentum, if you will, by virtue of simply the humanity that's in that room when it actually becomes transparent And the beautiful thing I have found, and I just love this, I think it's like gravity, is compassion comes forward rather than judgment. And we're so afraid that it's going to be judged and criticized. But in these situations, I find that it's compassion, not judgment, because nobody in that room is exempt from some form of trauma, pain, or fear daily. And just the fact that they can maybe come out from behind that is a huge amount of relief. And to do it collectively is way better than on your own. So that's why I love working in the workplace. Does that speak to what you're
It does. So, everybody has to get in there. And it's a responsibility to yourself first, but it ultimately ends up helping the organization.
Absolutely. No one can make it safe. It's not, when it comes to my a boss, HR department, no one can make a place safe for people being real and open with one another. It has to start with individual commitments. And I say leaders go first. And I tell that to the, I work through the leaders. They've got to show up and inspire the people that work for them that they're not kidding about this. And then the people come out from hiding because there is the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so we got to handle that authority problem first.
All right. The boss goes first.
Yes.
All right. So Thompson Barton and Don White have been doing this for years. It's in a book form now called Please Lie to Me. That is the usual agreement as they see it. Then they get to the new agreement in a third part of the book called Accountable Consciousness. Thompson Barton, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're welcome. Delighted.
Good to have you.